Sound shapes our lives in ways we often don't even notice. From the way we experience technology, to the emotions that music stirs, to the subtle cues that guide us through digital worlds. Today, we're diving into that invisible force with someone who's made a career out of turning sound into impact. Manon Dave is a creative technologist, music producer, and entrepreneur who's worked at the intersection of innovation, design, and audio. He's developed products for global brands, collaborated with iconic artists, and built experiences that don't just look good, they feel good. In this episode, we explore how sound influences human behavior and what the future of immersive audio holds for all of us. Let's get into it and welcome to Hear Us Out, Manon and Dave.
Thank you so much, Eric. And yeah, real pleasure to be here. I know we've been trying to do this for a while, and I know that you've rehearsed that intro a few times. Thanks for me more justice than I deserve.
Hey, our pleasure. So why don't you tell us a little bit about your view on music, technology, design, as those being areas that can merge together for a unique career path?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think if anybody asked me that at the beginning of my career, I would have just said that sounds like a pipe dream. But to be honest, you know, the convergence of technology with all mediums, especially music and entertainment, has been like nothing short of, you know, revolutionary. And I think what's ended up happening is folks like me who are, I would describe myself as like particularly average in all of those fields. But you know, being, I guess, what some folks describe as maybe a generalist, and being able to pick up those skills and sharpen them and kind of point that in the direction of something that I want to achieve has led me to be able to build a career that I think that allows me to kind of coexist and collaborate and build things that audiences seem to be drawn to. And maybe I would argue offers a slightly different perspective or a different twist on some of the stuff that might have been produced if someone like myself wasn't involved. So I think where we're at now, it's really the age of the kind of the generalist becoming maybe more of a core part of these worlds and these industries, and the tools that are emerging are just accelerating that.
Can you talk a little bit about some of the differences specifically that you feel like you are bringing to different projects?
Yeah, I mean, so, you know, I think my background is, you know, it's in music as a composer, producer, somebody who wanted to make music for a long time. I couldn't play an instrument, so I actually learned to make music through computers, and I guess the equivalent of like pixel painting music in MIDI. And so I came at sound from a very visual point of view, and I came at music from a very kind of technological point of view. So I think that was, I would say, a unique approach at the time. And then as things have shifted and that kind of approach to music making, for example, has become more populous, my same kind of creative instincts being applied to other technical fields such as product design have ended up meaning that same slightly awkward, but still it kind of makes sonic sense, you know, in terms of the music I was making. That same sort of strange but fitting juxta seems to be taking place in, you know, or has taken place in some of the products I've built. So a good example is, you know, a little while ago, I was working with one of the biggest education companies in the world called EF. They actually have a huge building out in Boston, and they typically teach kind of English to folks around the world through kind of cultural experiences. And I was tasked with kind of leading the innovation side of things in China, where they were trying to build, or they have these schools that, you know, kids as young as 3 to 6 will go and try and learn English up to a certain standard by age 6, because there's, you know, the parents want the kids to kind of get into certain schools, and there's like exams and all this kind of stuff, right? So kind of high pressure situation for kids, but they wanted to make that more fun, and they wanted to make it more engaging. And it was around the time 2018 when smart speakers were kind of having a boom in the home with Alexa and those kinds of things. And, you know, I don't know that much at all actually about music. I don't know that much at all about language education or even pedagogy at large. Like I was never the most academically gifted person, but I decided to take the gig and thought, yeah, you know, I could have fun with this and think about ways that if I was a kid, how would I like to be engaged? And I thought back to the age of when I had a Tamagotchi, if you guys remember that.
Of course.
I had a Tamagotchi when I was a kid, and it was just that, as I was listening to these PhDs in pedagogy and teaching, telling me what the kind of cadence and process was of getting a 3 to 6 year old to learn something, it immediately made me think of the mechanics of the Tamagotchi. It's about this thing learning with you, and as you discover a new skill, that skill is only something that you can utilize in that specific use case, such as feeding the Tamagotchi or cleaning up after the Tamagotchi or whatever it was, right? And so I took some of those, I thought about my youth and my experience with that, and I tried to map that experience to the methodology of teaching English through audio. And so I designed this smart speaker with my team called Study Buddy, little character that, is from the character universe that they had developed to teach these kids in the textbooks. And it's like a little owl with like E color e-ink eyes, which was the first of its kind at the time, back in the day. The Kindle color hadn't come out, and so it was very innovative on the hardware side. And then on the software and content side, it was the kid would get home from school, but this thing would be cloud connected, and teachers would be able to highlight, for example, issues that the child might have with like pronouncing R sounds, which is quite common, let's say, in China. And through songs and stories and conversation, at the level that the child is at, or just surpassing slightly the level that the child is at, this thing would essentially engage the child in language practice without feeling like that burdensome homework, high pressure moment. So I say all of that to say, look, that's you can I'll share some links with you guys so you can check that out. But I think that that kind of approach, that kind of innovation at a place like EF, I mean, we won a bunch of design awards, and I was at CES the following year winning an innovation award. This stuff, I think, doesn't happen unless you invite creatives to the table, or this multifaceted, technologists or generalists, whatever you want to call people like me, to the table that can kind of mishmash some of these passions, experiences, and tie them into real world use cases for folks who might need it.
You have your hand in so many different fields, whether it's music or cars or education, as you had just mentioned. How do you choose what projects you take on? Does it come with familiarity? Or does it come with either familiarity of the product? Does it come with interest of the product? How do you decide?
Yeah, I mean, I need to start getting more picky, that's for sure, because I do, because I've got too many plates spinning constantly, and I'm always reminded of it by those I love. But I think, to be honest, it's like I think there is a red thread that really kind of goes through it all, and it's really about I think unlocking potential, in people and people's engagements with these products. You could argue that, the Soundrive project with will.i.am and Mercedes, where we take music that you're listening to in the car and dynamically adapt it to the style of your driving, is, a fad or a gimmick or just something that is entertaining in the car for a little while. But truth be told, I think it's a completely different way of informing the user, of informing the driver about the conditions right now and the speed at which they're driving and the speed limit and the kind of angle at which they're turning right or left. There's information there in the sonics, which is one thing, but then there's also the connection, the actual user experience and the human computer interaction and the connection with the car, which was otherwise the engine. And so you accelerate with the engine and you feel that rumble, and it's a very physical way of controlling this machine. And I think, again, Soundrive is an example of how we can become playful with that. We can imagine a different way of doing that. And I think that's the sweet spot that I like to really play in, is that combination of technology, human interaction, creativity in some respects, but really the ability to kind of unlock something in a person, something creative in a person, ideally. And so when you're driving those cars, you're really kind of co-composing a remix of the song that you're listening to in real time. When you're when you're engaging with Study Buddy, you're interfacing with smart technology, but you're also kind of co-creating the story and the journey, and you're using your imagination. So I think that's kind of how I that's at least that's the stuff that kind of, gets me up in the morning and has me thinking about what I could contribute. It's projects that I think have an element of storytelling, invention, of course, naturally, ideally sound and music in some way, and and ultimately impact people and help them achieve what they're trying to achieve.
Do you think that sound is adequately factored into having that impact with technology, with storytelling, with product creation? Do you think you're focusing on sound in a way that is different from others that are in that specific space?
I mean, I would like to think so, not because I think I'm doing anything that shouldn't be done or doing something so iconically different, not at all. I think that actually everyone should be thinking about sound, but I think that that's actually the reason why I do feel I'm doing something different. Is actually, I'm pretty surprised as I hop from industry to industry. You know, I've worked in ad tech. I've worked in music tech, of course, especially on the creation side. I've worked in film. I've worked in automotive, as Michelle mentioned. I've worked with education. And I'm really honestly surprised, even in the music tech world, how the sound part is often the afterthought. You know, it's more the function in many cases, even in the music tech world, right? It's about functionality. It's about workflow. It's about ease of use. And of course, it's about sound. Like, you know, people are building sound libraries and synthesizers and so on. But a lot of the focus tends to be on where in the music making journey this tool fits in. And I feel that actually, getting from idea from your mind to the actual output and the actual sound, that should be as latency free as possible. Mm-hmm. And I think that's just in terms of the creation or even the music or sound consumption process. But then if you go into, you know, the world of information and entertainment and even advertising, I think it's often very undervalued, the part that it plays, you know, in storytelling. You know, it's almost the hidden character in any scene or the thing that kind of gets your hairs to stick up in the back of your neck when you see an ad that you react to in a particular way. So I think that that's what I try to inject into a lot of these projects, is the role that sound and music can play. And I try to do that very creatively and really try and weave that into the storytelling if possible.
With technology, is it's both a blessing and a curse that it is constantly evolving, and whatever was being used becomes obsolete and you have to learn a whole new form of technology. How do you keep up with that, where it's ever changing and software is different and the way that people go about, or AI now that's incorporated into it? How do you keep with the evolution of technology?
Yeah, I mean, I know it's very cliche to say, I just do it. And the truth is that the thing that I get excited about is the latest and greatest tool. I've definitely got shiny toy syndrome, that's for sure. But what I try to actively do, Michelle, is like, I do two things, actually. I find time to play. I really feel that we often get so caught up in output that, you know, it's difficult to give yourself permission to play. And I talked about this recently on stage at an event. In my family are from India, and specifically this region called the Gujarat. So we speak Gujarati. And in Gujarati, there's this saying or this proverb, I guess, but it's particularly targeted at, you know, if my kid's misbehaving, I'll be bemoaning the fact that he's not listening to me. And my granddad or my mother would say, ramta ramta sikse. And that translates directly to play, play, learn. And it's almost like a, you know, a lost mechanism that we have when we're children, you know, to discover and break and play and break and then learn how something fits in to, you know, to what we're supposed to be doing. And I just try to actively do that as much as I can, in and around the work. But actually, the moment I do that on a tight schedule in like a 30-minute gap between two very important meetings, typically what that does is it sparks a new idea and a new way of tackling a problem that I've actually got on my calendar or I've got on my agenda. And then very quickly, what tends to happen is I'll incorporate, let's say, visual AI or image AI or sound AI as a tool. I'll incorporate that into an active project in a very light touch way, in a way that's not going to offend anyone. Or if it doesn't work out, it's not going to, you know, everything's not resting on that. Ultimately, I'm immediately putting that tool to work and trying to see and trying to understand the possibilities of it. So I've tried to do that a few times over. I mean, a great example is recently at the Paris Olympics. We created this campaign, myself, a friend of mine, Shay Lingo, who's an artist and Framestore, a big VFX company. around the world. They make all the Marvel movies and all the rest of it. We were tasked with...
It's time to get organized this new year with Menards. Update your closet system and add style today with Closet Culture. Choose from two closet finishes and four colors of shelf boards to create a functional yet stylish closet solution that matches your home decor. Check out all our Closet Culture closet kits or view our weekly flyer on Menards.com to see all the great deals happening now. Save big money
at Menards. Creating the first ever campaign for the refugee team, the Olympic refugee team. They've always been around for the last few Olympics. They always wear like white, like complete white kits with no logos. And they meet on the day of the Olympic Games opening. They don't, half of them don't speak the same language. Like they really have no camaraderie. And apart from their individual supporters, you'd argue maybe even not many supporters. And so the idea was to like, you know, build this campaign for them. And to me, that's, you know, of course, a great ad with a great soundtrack. But with everything going on with the refugee crisis and 100 million refugees around the world, and everyone's got a number on their backs, and these 15 people, all they want to do is just compete at the very highest level with absolutely no labels attached. That became this kind of animated world that I started to imagine with my team. And we actually trained and kind of Gen AI, kind of a visual AI pipeline on the illustrations of a refugee artist to essentially animate this kind of world that these athletes were trapped in until a point where they kind of reach boiling point and break out of that world, and they arrive in, you know, in Paris in the Olympic Stadium. And that was kind of like the arc of the ad. But again, we did that. So that was Paris Olympics was last year, as you know, in the summer. And we started that work, let's say, maybe a year prior to that. So we're talking about, you know, mid-2023, there weren't very many ad campaigns with generative AI at the heart of it, especially not global brands like the Olympic Games. So that's what happens, I think. You know, 6 months prior to that, I was noodling around with making images and trying to turn them into video with generative AI. So I think stuff will kind of come out in the wash if you just keep playing and keep learning and, you know, and then trying to apply that to whatever it is that you're, you know, it naturally you'll start thinking of that as a tool.
This makes me think of conversations we've had with musicians where they'll say to us, I hear the melody in my head. Now I need to find it on my instrument. I need to find the voicing of it. And you talked about sound in a visual way. Can you talk about how maybe your process is for taking this one sensory thought or sensory experience and translating it to another? We've spoken with photographers and talk about capturing emotion with light, and then with musicians with capturing emotion with sound. And from what you're describing, it sounds like you're really working with those two at times as one. And there's something really interesting in that to me. I'm curious to hear more about.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's actually, there's three things that have always been kind of in my wheelhouse just in terms of like consumption. Like I'd watch a heck of a lot of movies, cartoons, TV shows, like get lost in fantasy. I'd do the same with music, you know, hours and hours on end, radio, tape, making my own mixtapes, then until I started playing around with making my own music. And the third one, which is maybe why I was drawn to education in some ways, was, although I was never the academic really, I really was in love with language and just toying with language. And, you know, maybe it came from songwriting, maybe it came from some of that fiction that, you know, that I'd watch or read. But I just loved poetry and songwriting and metaphors and similes and just all the tools, all the apparatus of language. But so oftentimes, you know, when I'm thinking about, for example, designing a product, I'm working on a project right now for a gut microbiome technology, right? Like, so it's a health tech. And again, I just know nothing about that. And I'm kind of scared to discover it, you know, just because I really don't want to know kind of what's inside. And
let it work on its own.
Just let it work. Like, I'm too afraid. I'm too much of a sissy to try and like stop trying to fix stuff that's so badly broken in me. But you know, it's interesting. Like, it's something that's so complex and so difficult to communicate to people that, listen, if you do a DNA test when you're born and you do a DNA test when you're like 90, your DNA is going to be absolutely identical, but on both of those occasions. no difference whatsoever, indifferentiable, actually. But the microbiome, that evolves and changes through time, and that, you know, evolves as you kind of develop your diet, as you, you know, your health changes. Also, it has predispositions based on, you know, family history and of illnesses, diseases, mm-hmm. whatever. And all of that stuff is a lot of information for a company that wants to try and democratize that experience and that product in a way where people can start to become more aware of it. They can start to use their phones and other things to track it, to affect it, you know. Mm-hmm. So how do you bring those things together? And just to give you a little glimpse into this in real time, like the CEO of that company said to me in a meeting, he's like, you know, the one big difference between us is like, between us and all of the other health tech companies is that they all focus on things that you can see in the outside world, right? You know, your the impact of your walk or your run or your exercise, whatever, or your nutrition. Whereas what we do is we kind of turn the lights on inside mm-hmm. your gut, you know, and so you can see what's really happening inside your gut. And just that phrase, turn your lights on, and maybe this is just my weird way of mm-hmm. concocting a new idea, I immediately thought of this like 1980s throwaway movie called Inner Space. You guys ever watch Inner Space?
No, I haven't seen that.
Yeah. Inner Space is this film. Hold on, I'm going to tell you right now who's in it. Inner Space is this film, which it's just, it can only ever happen in the 80s, right? It's in 1987. And it's a film which...
one more time.
it's starring Martin Short and Dennis Quaid. It's a funny, it's a hilarious movie where it's like, I don't know, this couple kisses. And then it's like Honey, I Shrunk the Kids or whatever. And then they kind of are inside each other's bodies or something, right? Uh-huh. And then like, in like these little spacecraft.
Makes me think of Herman's Head.
Yeah, I'm probably butchering the plot here, but it's like, it's all of a sudden you start to see, you know, the size and shape and texture of blood cells and you know, the different organs in the body. And so I started thinking about that. And then I started thinking about, you know, phrases, punchlines, like almost as if I was writing a rap verse on like elements of, you know, the kind of a quaint way of like positioning what could happen inside of your body. And, you know, like the being able to decipher the secrets of your body or whatever. And those things started to create this almost audio visual version of how I understood the brand could look or feel. And then, you know, the guys I was working with, we started talking about what are we going to do? How are we going to design this new version of this app? And I don't want to give too much away, but I was lying down with the blinds half open on a sunny day like today. And, you know, you kind of get the shine of light on your walls with the kind of shadow of your blinds. And, you know, and you'll see that on a table sometimes, or as you're lying down in bed on the ceiling. And I started to think about those light refractions as like a unique to each person and each room and with whatever perspective you have. As the light moves, everything else can be static, but as the light changes, the position of those shadows and the position of that light moves. So that became like an entire visual metaphor for how your body's gut microbiome changes. And that became essentially the DNA, if you like, of the visual design of the application of the entire app. So, and then through that, all of those punchlines and throwaway strap lines came in to flow the actual storytelling of the product. And before you know it, we're now creating an ad, which will then need to be soundtracked with all of that stuff to tell the tale. But I literally can't design the app unless I go through that process. And so I don't know if that answers your question, but it's like, it's a multi-sensory process, I feel, to develop, you know, to kind of leverage the technology and develop the actual story. I think that's the right way around of doing it, at least for people like me.
So I feel like the follow-on to that is, if somebody's bilingual, you might ask, what language do you think in? What you're describing to me is like a sensory bilingualness. That which yeah. language do you think in? Do you think in the visual? Do you think in the auditory, or is it a merge?
Yeah, I think it is a merge. And I think it's, you know, there was something, this is one of those things that, again, you know, what do they say? The a silent mind is the devil's playground or whatever, right? But my son was born in December 2019, and he was born premature. So we're in the hospital for a little while, And I'd be by his bedside and whatever. And I don't know, like everyone, we all have our little tics, right? So I'd be tapping my feet or like tapping my leg or whatever. And I started to realize, just because it was so dead quiet for days on end, that I'm always tapping at exactly the same tempo. And I was like, why is that? It's like, that's a strange thing, you know what I mean? And then I started to like observe people, and I started to realize that everyone has their own weird tempo that they tap to or tick to or whatever. And
Resonant frequency.
then I started, I was just sat there with my laptop and doing work at the time or whatever. So I actually made a little EP of music to the tempo of things around, like people around me, my son's heartbeat, a variable heartbeat, my own tap, the lady opposite us, and the nurses that would come in and tap their feet whilst taking blood. So like that was the kind of, that I feel was the auditory part. But then there's also still auditory, but linguistic part. I think the way that we describe things, the way that we compare things, imagine things, that plays a big part in my, again, in my process. And then visual, of course, like when you're talking to me about even this topic and this question that you just asked, that immediately took me back to being in hospital with my son. So I think that, I don't think that this is something that I've practiced or anything like that. I think it's something that innately is in all of us. Like we have all of these signs that are indicating towards our process. And I think it's very easy for us to want to follow frameworks. Sometimes we just need to follow the framework of our own minds.
Talking about this EP where it took you back, it makes me think that, of course, no matter what company you're working for, there are certain guidelines to follow, but how much of your own personal style and preferences do you infuse into your projects?
Yeah, this is something that I have struggled with in the past, and I've really tried to turn the corner on, to be honest, because you have to kind of like really, at least in my experience, I've been in situations in workplaces where it's, you're very much sandboxed to, as you say, the processes and frameworks and ways of working, ways of innovating that are set out and are appropriate, let's say, for that environment. And I think that everybody at some point, even if they don't want to, will probably go through a period where they're absolutely miserable. I hope they don't, but they're absolutely miserable at work, right? And they're miserable because they know they can, usually because they know they can do more, or because they don't feel heard or seen, or they feel that there is a better way of doing something. And what I realize, I think, over time, especially as I sort of left the music tech world, I was doing that full time for 6 or 7 years between Berlin and London, and probably had some of the biggest successes of my career at that time in terms of product development. And some of my products were in Apple stores multiple Christmases on end, and we raised surplus of $60 million in funding for different projects, and had all kinds of famous people involved in the creation and consumption of those products. But I in that 6 or 7 year process, I made the least music of my entire life. Like I just wasn't making music, even though I was building music tech products. So it's really a weird thing, right? And I think that often happens to folks, is that they spend so long doing the thing in a way that that it doesn't feel natural, that you almost get exhausted because you're not injecting your own process, your own way of thinking, your own approach. So since that, I really make a point of it, and I really make a point of going into every project trying to be as candid as possible about the fact that, hey, look, you're probably not going to, get a daily update and a daily or a weekly demo or whatever. It's just going to come to me, and then I'm just going to piece things together, and you're going to have to just trust me that I'm a collaborative person. I want to work with people to get the best ideas out. There's no restrictions, there's no hierarchy. I want every idea to be heard, and really anyone can have the best idea. And then it's just sometimes curation is harder than creation, and sometimes it just takes for somebody to, again, take the best of those ideas and string that together into something that's more of an experience, more of a product. So yeah, that's how I try to approach it. And I would say that now it's become almost a prerequisite to say, hey, look, if I'm going to get involved, then this is how I'm going to best impact the project. And if I can't do it that way, I might still really want to do it, but you may not get the best out of me.
stands out in a lot of the conversations we've had on our podcast that some of the people who are having the most success in their industries are collaborating. They recognize they don't know everything. They recognize there are other great ideas in the room and that the other professionals are bringing something to the table. And there's a humility in that. And these days in social media world where everybody's, I look at me, this is what I'm doing. Talk about your kind of internal makeup, internal thought that allows you to have that humility to recognize other people are bringing value and you can shine a light on that, that is also still shining a light on you.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's...
Forget the pressure to overhaul your life. The new year doesn't need a new you. It needs you. Grow Therapy helps you make meaningful change at your pace and on your time. Grow connects you with thousands of independent, licensed therapists across the U.S., offering both virtual and in-person sessions, nights and weekends. There are no subscriptions, no long-term commitments. You just pay per session. Grow accepts over 100 insurance plans, including Medicaid in some states. Sessions average about $21 with insurance, and some pay as little as $0, depending on their plan. Visit growtherapy.com/try now today to get started. That's growtherapy.com/try now. Availability and coverage vary by state and insurance plan.
A sort of combination of my upbringing from a personal perspective as well as a professional one, because the stuff I'm doing now or even the last 8 to 10 years, Eric, honestly, is it's like I won the lottery. Like I'm not complaining about anything, you know what I mean? Like, but yeah, where I come from, people don't get to do stuff like this, so I've already won, and that kind of definitely adds to the idea of being humble, because I'm always on edge and always ready to go back to eating pot noodles and working 3 jobs, you know what I mean? Because I know I can do it, and I know I would do it to try and achieve this again. So I think that's always that stuff, I think, is always just, you got to be humble, because you never know when it's all gone. But that's from my upbringing, and I grew up, we didn't have much when we grew up, and everything was aspirational, you know, to even, we have uniforms here in the UK, as you probably know, for schools. And so very few schools allow you to go in without a uniform. But even like the idea of like putting on the uniform, like that specific blazer, you know, it was always like, it was aspirational, because we knew how much it cost. And we knew that like, if I get in, we're going to need to start saving so we can afford the uniform, you know? So it was like that kind of upbringing. So that always, I think, kept me rooted. But honestly, when I started, in my first job, I started as a really crappy software engineer and didn't last very long, and then got, I wouldn't say relegated, but they were like, all right, let's try this guy as a quality assurance tester for this ad tech software. Did that for a little while, but again, you know, I would get frustrated, because I'd be able to find and identify problems, but I always had an idea and a solution, and that wasn't my job. So then it wasn't really heard. And then I stumbled upon this kind of sweet spot of product management, and where, you know, I was essentially the outward facing representative of the product, person to organize and prioritize tasks for the team to improve the product. And ultimately, I started to realize, like, oh, all those ideas I had on how to solve some of these things, I'm actually in charge now, so I can actually prioritize these things, and I can implement them, and or I can at least suggest what I feel and give reasoning behind why I feel a particular way of doing things might work. And honestly, it was kind of the, you can call it humility, but also I think just actually the very practical nature of engineers, the traditional engineer, where the solution is the solution. So all of a sudden I started to realize that people who I just thought hated my guts because I was constantly badgering them about doing something slightly different, had actually, well, now hearing me and going, they were challenging me, going, well, why would we do that? That doesn't make any sense. All of a sudden to going, okay, that makes sense. I mean, maybe I can do it like this, but I get what you're saying. I'll find the solution. I'll come back to you, you know? And that's when I started to really see that, much like in music, much like in the room, as we like to call it in the music industry, the songwriter, the producer, the band, you know, the bassist, the drummer, all of these people are fantastic on their own. They might be able to out-drum or out-bass anyone, but you're not really making the thing that the consumer, that the end user, the consumer in this case, the listener, is going to really powerfully engage with, unless you're doing it together and everyone gets their little contribution. You know, you can't, it doesn't feel the same if there is no drum line or if the guitarist's playing the drums. Like, it's not quite the same thing. So I think that perspective I've carried, you know, throughout my career is, you can never be sure you're going to have it tomorrow. But B, I think only the combination of those things, that's why I became a music producer, because I think I was so fascinated by the fact that half these guys didn't play any of the instruments on the songs, and they didn't necessarily write the lyrics. But it is that curation of what everyone's created that means that, you know, you get the best result.
You ever have a time where, I'll call it the equivalent of having writer's block, where you just feel stuck in the process? And if so, what do you do to overcome that? Do you collaborate with others? Where do you search for inspiration to overcome any sort of challenge of feeling stuck in the middle of a project?
Yeah, I think every time I talk about this on stage, or if I'm answering a question about this, people genuinely think I'm, like, you know, we say in the UK, taking the piss, like having a laugh, you know what I mean? Like, and making fun of the question. I'm genuinely not. What I do to tackle writer's block or imposter syndrome or anything that's kind of stopping me from pushing things in a different direction, and sometimes it's just pure exhaustion from debating it with folks in the team or whatever, is go back to, like, just completely monging out and just being a consumer. And I do that just by consuming those things that I was talking about before. I'll just sit and binge watch something. And I know it's not the healthiest thing. I should say go out for a walk and track my blood oxygen levels. But no, I will, like, just sit and binge watch. I'll consume heavily, not junk food, but I'll consume creative output, you know, because the creative process requires you to really kind of, like, regurgitate all of that stuff in different combinations, right? Whether people like to admit it or not, like, they're constantly sampling and resampling their own experiences and all the experiences of others from their perspective. And so I find it fuel to go and consume more of those experiences and to feed, I think, my work with somebody else's work. You know, and so whether that's TV or music or even video games or going and watching a game with my son, or I try to completely detach from it. And I actually learned this from my high school French teacher, who told me about this. This is probably pseudoscience. I actually don't know the science behind it, but she told me when I was really struggling in French, and I still can't speak French, but she was like, you know, there is a study that proves that if you listen to the language, or if you listen to music or audiobook or whatever, subconsciously you'll start, like, absorbing a lot of the detail around how to reconstruct that. That's how melodies stick, that's how a bunch of other things stick. So I became an absolute aficionado over the course of 1 year in French hip-hop. Just listen to, like, French rap music going to sleep every night, to the point where I'd be on the train in London in the morning and I'd be sure that someone's speaking French around me until I listen really closely and then realize I'm just picking up the certain sounds, you know, of certain phonemes that are commonly used in the French language. I'd just be hearing those phonemes and being alerted when actually someone was just speaking English. So it's a really, I'm going to go and research that, actually. You just reminded me of it. And I just about scraped my C in French, so super delighted.
So in music production and being in the room, can you talk about that experience? In my head, I'm thinking of you're sitting at the hospital bed and you're tapping and your body's kind of operating on this beat. When you find success in production, aggregating these talents and putting it all together, what is that like? Is it everybody's on the same beat? Everybody's kind of working as one and it comes together to create this thing? Or is that a process you feel like you have to manage?
I think as the producer, you try to, maybe manage is the wrong word, but again, the curation process doesn't start and stop with the music. I think the curation process starts the moment that people enter the room, really, right? So you're kind of responsible for almost creating the vibe of the room. And I think a lot of that is different people handle it differently. I've been in the room with producers who don't say a word and let the artist drive the session. I've been in the room with producers who are the, you know, the orchestrators, if you like, of the entire session. My personal approach is similar to how I make products. You know, I think you recognize when you're building companies and building products that it's very, very, very difficult. And maybe now with AI and everything else, it's different. But Otherwise, it's very difficult to have to build something truly outstanding without the cocktail of skills in the room. And I think so I try to invite ideas. I try to really invite ideas and try to build rapport and trust so that they can trust me with their ideas. And ultimately, a producer's job, you know, in my view, is to reflect the story that the artist is trying to tell, whether that's contributing, you know, through sound design and sculpting and shaping the piece of music, or whether it's directly co-writing with them to help articulate through lyrics or through melodies, you know, that particular story or that particular, or scoring that particular scene. So my approach in music, or maybe vice versa, my approach in product and technology has been somewhat shaped by my experience in music.
Project you've worked on that has stood out as being one of your favorites, of either being really proud of it or taking a particular interest in it?
Well, yeah, I mean, there's an endless amount. I think I'm honestly super proud of the Refugee Olympic campaign, because first of all, it just feels like unfathomable to be able to have the opportunity to create something that is then debuted at the Olympic opening ceremony. So this particular campaign film was shown all the way down the Champs-Élysées in Paris as the boats with all of the athletes came in. It was on the screens, you know, being screened. But then that idea of fusing AI and emerging technology and my passion of making music and writing music, and of course the, you know, kind of unimaginable stories of the Olympic refugee team individually and collectively, into something that would be an iconic moment in history. I think that for me was, you know, was a super proud moment. Furthermore, what ended up happening, what we didn't realize at the time, was no Olympic refugee team member in however many Olympics they've been around for, I think 6 or 7, nobody had ever won a medal. That kind of begged the question, well, what would happen if an Olympic refugee team member won a medal? What would they play? Because mm-hmm. there's no national anthem for the Olympics, for the refugee team. There's no national anthem. And I think the answer we got back from the IOC was that, well, they'd be playing the Olympic theme tune, which I honestly couldn't hum to you if I tried. I don't even know what that is. Do you guys know?
I'm hearing the song they play like when they go to commercials during the Olympics.
I don't know if that's
Olympics.
Exactly. Yeah. So it's like, I don't even know what that is. How would this individual who might win and make history kind of connect with that, you know, with that piece of music? And because to me, that's so powerful, right? You see people in tears moved by the national anthem. So I created an orchestral arrangement of the song that we scored the campaign to, which was a hip hop record. We wanted it to feel almost like a Nike commercial, right? Like these really determined athletes putting on these headphones and kind of grappling with their futures, you know, in the ad. But that, of course, not necessarily appropriate for a national anthem. So I created an orchestral version of that in the hope that maybe one day somebody would win an Olympic medal. And of course, as fate would have it, at the Paris Olympics, Cindy Ngamba, a boxer in the female category female boxing category at the Olympics, won the bronze, first ever medal to be awarded to an Olympic refugee team member. As she took the podium, it was that piece of music that played. So yeah, pretty epic. And who knows, they might go and get Hans Zimmer or somebody to actually score the real anthem moving forward. But at least there's a point in history where, you know, we managed to contribute to it. So I'd say that's the one I've been most proud of. But honestly, anything and everything that I work on now, I'm like completely, you know, completely over the moon to at least have an opportunity to take part.
Did you create that with an orchestra or with AI, that specific music piece that was used for the Olympics?
No, so the music itself was completely composed and produced by me and songwriter. It was a guy called Shay Lingo, a rapper here in the UK. So there was no AI used in the music creation, but my method of making music is obviously entirely technology driven. So there was no musician that came into the room and created anything with me. I pretty much pixel painted, as I said, like drew into MIDI the musical notation. I think we sampled a couple of live instruments as well. And when I then orchestrated it, you know, to be an orchestral piece for the anthem, for the Olympics themselves, that was all the strings, all the bassoons and the double basses and the piano parts, that was all in the box, as we say, meaning it was all MIDI instruments, software instruments. So Yeah. So if you know, if you heard it, the Olympics, you'd be hearing essentially a computer's interpretation of those instruments.
Are there any ethical concerns with that idea of creating music with software versus instruments?
I think respectfully, that ship has sailed in the music industry, at least because we've been doing it for so long at this point. But I get what you're saying. You know, at some point there was, I mean, if you go way back, the advent of MIDI, you know, the kind of MIDI music computer interface protocol, already that was kind of frowned upon, right? Like, what are you talking about? Like, you know, you can, this doesn't sound like music. This is a computer receiving information and trying to make a sound, right? But that's not music. And then as that evolved over 35 years and it became essentially the language of music when it comes to every single record you hear on the radio, every single film you watch and every piece of music, with very, 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 very few exceptions, if any, use MIDI in one way or another, right? Because that's how you record music today, you know? So, and I think software instruments or VSTs, virtual software instruments, you know, as followed shortly thereafter over the last couple of decades. So that they've kind of embedded themselves in the process. And I don't think that there are any real ethical questions around that too much anymore, other than philosophical questions maybe from the real purists. But I think AI, if that's what you're alluding to, like, is following swiftly behind, you know, in the sense that, yeah, there are people right now who are like, you know, you can't just type something in and print a song. Like, that doesn't make sense. You shouldn't be able to do that. It's not right, especially if it's trained on the art of others. So there is that stance. I prefer the more optimistic one where, you know, especially coming from a background where the kind of music I made when I was growing up was hip hop music, and, you know, a lot of people would frown upon sampling. In my mind, that's an art form, right? Like, it's you're interpreting a very small segment of a piece of somebody else's art or music and remixing that. It's no different in my mind to being inspired by the story of a particular person or a film and translating that into a song. With your own melody. Like, I think it's one and the same. And I know the folks like me who in the industry who are using AI as part of their process now, and I think more and more people are on a daily basis, are seeing it the same way. It's a new person in the room to bounce your ideas off of and get new ideas back, or it's a new instrument that you can play, or it's a new tool that you can use to streamline your creative process.
Interesting. Yeah. As I was thinking about that question, I'm thinking about how sound is manipulated in a studio, whether it's effect pedals, whether it's software, that these things have been around. It just almost seems like there's more of a question mark these days of where is it going to go because the technology advances so quickly.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's, you know, it's, you have to draw parallels, I think, with other art forms. Like, what would, you know, what would Da Vinci think about graffiti? You know what I mean? Like, and you know, there are so many ways of chopping it up. I mean, even I watched the interview the other day between Mark Zuckerberg and Satya Nadella, where Mark Zuckerberg asks, you know, so what proportion of code would you estimate now inside of Microsoft's products is written by AI? And Satya Nadella gave, you know, fairly elaborate answer, but boils down to, he said 20 to 30% probably today of code written in our applications is AI. All these companies have had mass redundancies. You know, an engineer, software engineer in particular in the modern age, is as proud as a songwriter or a musician or a visual artist in terms of what they've made and how they construct it and the idea they had to develop that feature or tweak that feature. So arguably the ethical question, you know, kind of cuts across all of these things. And not to get overly philosophical, but I think it does, you know, that question has been raised, and I've been doing a lot of talks recently around what is humanity's role in all of this, in this new age of AI? And the soft plug that I'm going to give is at South by Southwest London coming up in June. June 2nd is my talk. But yeah, South by in London, I'm going to be giving a talk called Ideas Not Included. And really the kind of concept is, you know, when we were kids, we'd be buying those toys and you'd get the little sticker on it that says batteries not included. And really that's kind of where we're at with technology as a whole. And I think it's always been that way, that you can have all the tools in the world, but respectfully, Eric, you might use, you know, ChatGPT or Midjourney, let's say one way. Michelle will use it another way. and I'll use it another way, and we all have the power of natural language English, because that's how you communicate with these things. But for some reason, Michelle's one will be the best one. And we will, and she's the person who can wield that tool better than anybody else in the group. And that ultimately, that imagination that Michelle will have above us is the thing that would set her apart. And so I'm a real big believer that all of these things are only as good as the ideas that we can bring to the table. And so you're back to square one. It's like, who are you, you know, who's bringing the ideas to the table? Who's curating those ideas? And then fundamentally, how do we continue making stuff in a world where these things exist?
Fascinating. Absolutely fascinating. And so curious where it goes.
Yeah.
As we said, it just evolves so quickly. ChatGPT certainly was not a thing, at least that I was familiar with, within a year ago. And now it's all the rage.
It's your business.
So what's next for you? Either what's coming up that you're working on, or what's something that you want to get your hands on that you haven't touched on yet, but what's the dream of something you want to get involved with?
Well, I mean, I never stop dreaming. So I'm definitely keen to, I think, get more into some of those verticals that I was inspired by as a kid. Like, I've had the luxury of now working with a lot of my heroes and working, you know, in the music industry, as I mentioned, a lot of the brands and products that I'm a consumer of, I had the opportunity to work with those folks. But some of the verticals where, like, I have far less practical experience, but still have ideas that I think I can contribute, and maybe skills now, or as Eric put it, this slightly different perspective or process that I could bring to the table, are places like film and the more visual media. I've had the opportunity recently to do some immersive installation stuff, and really enjoyed that, you know, kind of creating entire experiences, you know, physical experiences around technology and sound and visualizations of stories, I think is exciting to me. Sports is another one where I'm a huge fan of sports, and sports has been really good about adopting data. But I think, you know, seeing how I could contribute in that world with, again, having sound play a part in that experience of either attending sports virtually or having a more of a engaging fan experience. The things that happen between games, you know, the podcasting is such a huge thing, as you guys know already, and people are constantly listening to debates and different things within that world, and seeing what role AI and sound could play in kind of the fantasy sports world and things like that, I think is really exciting. But really, I think one of the areas that I'm super excited about is getting involved in organizations that are really making an impact. I think the refugee campaign has alerted me towards an itch that I need to scratch now, which is like, I want to make more impact like that. And I'm sure they won't mind me sharing on this, that recently I've been engaging and working really closely with Red, or Product Red, you know, the charity that Bono from U2 mm-hmm. started. And he's, you know, he originally started it to kind of help to erase the HIV epidemic, and that effort continues. They're also, you know, they've been around for 20 years or 19 years. Next year is the 20th year anniversary of their founding. And I think there'll be a big push to, I think, remind everyone that the work is not done. And again, I want to try and contribute to that in a really meaningful way. So yeah, those are the areas that I'm excited to work in and passionate about. And I'm trying to take initiative to do that as well. I recently started a charity in the name of my late daughter Maya, to, you know, help young girls get into music education, whether that's music technology or playing an instrument. So those are the kinds of initiatives that I think are, you know, at the helm of my 40th birthday, which was yesterday.
Happy birthday!
Thank you. Having my midlife crisis moment and realizing I need to leave a lasting impact. So that's what I'm doing next, I think.
That's beautiful. That's beautiful that you started the charity for music education that is very impactful. And leading into my last question for you, we ask a lot on the podcast about, have our guests ever found that they've been a part of somebody's story where you've had an impact on somebody else, either someone that you've worked with or someone that has been impacted by one of your products? Can you tell us about a time that you may have been a part of somebody else's story?
I mean, yeah, with Maya's scholarship, we've already funded over the last 2 years, three young girls across India and the UK who are in university studies for a variety of musical disciplines, from classical music to pop, music and pop music courses in Manchester through to music production courses in India. So yeah, so that's been amazing. And I can't wait to see how all of that unravels. But I'd say that like we're constantly bumping into things and readjusting the course of different people and careers and lives, or even if we don't know it, all of us. And when that stuff comes to fruition, again, it's one of those that you don't really talk about. You don't want to name names, but I have a friend who went through a tough time and I didn't really even know him that much at the time, but we lived in the same area, had a lot of the same interests. We knew of each other. He's a really great musician. And at the time I was working on the Roly products, you know, the music tech products. And he hit me up on Facebook at the time and was like, hey, look, you know, I've just gone through this situation. I'm now coming up for air and I want to get back into things, but I don't want to dive straight into the music industry. I'd rather like, you know, work adjacent to that. And if you have any opportunities, not looking for a handout, I just want to, you know, just want to work on some stuff. And actually at the time I was really struggling to help my software engineering team and hardware engineering teams understand why some of the ways in which we were designing this product were not going to be the most efficient way of using the product for musicians. And I was like, what better way to bring in a musician who has some technical understanding, being a producer, and get him to help them understand this. And that turned into, you know, a few years of him working there before he moved on. And ultimately, when he left, he got the opportunity to go back to the studio where he first began and completely gut it and rebuild it from the ground up and build a community there. And he's now done that 3 or 4 times over. And we were still very, very good friends. And I go where he goes, really. But that is something that, A, I'm proud of, but B, I think it reminds you that actually it's not just about doing a good thing or whatever, but there are skills and there are insights and perspectives everywhere. And if we can lean into those sometimes, even in an unorthodox way, even in an otherwise unqualified way, sometimes you get surprised, or you can certainly surprise them, showing those people what they're capable of. So yeah, I guess that's one anecdote.
You know, it's something I haven't shared on the pod before. About 11 years ago, my nephew was a baby and he died. And somebody said to me at the time, you'll never be the same. And I didn't understand it at the time. And I think looking back, one of the ways that that event changed or shaped me was to recognize things like that actually happen. Things like that can occur out in the world. And my last question for you is, how does Maya's memory kind of inform you and the way you engage with the world and with life?
Yeah, first of all, you know, I'm really sorry to hear that. And you know, nobody, I'd be wrong to say I know what, you know, what that feels like, but we all deal with it differently. But yeah, for me, you know, we all cope in different ways. And I think my coping mechanism was immediately to sort of say, I can't have it that those 11 days or, you know, 11 days is all she got, right? Like I couldn't compute that. And then that person disappears and I celebrate my 40th birthday yesterday and it's all cushy and we keep it moving. Mm-hmm. That surely can't be it. And so that led me to, I think, want to ensure that people who are not necessarily the end of their life, which is a very drastic thing to think about, but people who don't really have a way out of the box, let's call it, folks really like us, me when I was growing up as well, like, we didn't imagine all this, right? So there are people in that position right now. And I like to think of that as the position that maybe Maya was in, sort of metaphorically speaking, but somebody should open the door, or open the box, or kick the window open, or whatever, you know? And I feel like that's the philosophy that I've sort of taken from it, which is where possible, kind of just leave the door ajar a little bit. And that will just help the next person walk through it. And so I think that's sort of how it's changing my perspective. The actions, I think, are sometimes, you know, require to be planned sometimes. So, you know, getting the scholarship done and all that stuff is a process and it's not easy, but it doesn't mean that everyone needs to go and do that. I think we can just be a bit more cognizant of the fact that, there's gonna need to be a huge shift in whichever industry you're in because of technology, because of sociopolitical circumstances, or just because the world moves on. And so I think if you can try and inject that little bit of outside thinking or fresh thinking, we can start to kind of invite more voices to the table, then yeah, give somebody else an opportunity. So that's that, I'd say that's how it's affected me.
Appreciate you sharing that. So why don't you tell everybody where they can find your work, where they can hear about what you're up to?
Yeah, I mean, I'm pretty easy to find. It's just at @manondave. That's M-A-N-O-N-D-A-V-E. Pretty much on all platforms. I'm on Instagram. I'm on LinkedIn. You'll see me pop up, I think, from time to time in a few other platforms. When it comes to the music, I'm on SoundCloud, Spotify, Apple Music, all the rest of it. So yeah, if you follow any one of those channels, I typically post the same thing everywhere because I'm extremely lazy and I've spent all my days curating the product, so I can't curate my own social media, sadly.
Well, we'll link to all of that in the description. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast to share about your really fascinating work. We've been looking forward to this one because you have such an interesting job. We've been dying to hear all about it. So thank you so much. And we're looking forward to seeing what you do next.
Thank you so much, Michelle. Thank you, Eric.
Thanks for taking your time with us. We appreciate it.
All right.
All right. Take care. Yep.